welcome to The Chat. My name is Leah Tsumoglu. Each week on The Chat, we shine a light on the lives and careers of UTS alumni here at the 2SER studios. This week, my guest on the show is Dr. Michelle Sanson, who is a gender and protection specialist. Michelle also works for the UN as the entity for gender equality and the empowerment of women. Let's take a listen to her story. To begin, when you first started studying law in 1999, did you know that you wanted to go down the humanitarian and international law path? Is this what you were thinking?
Yeah, I guess when I first started, I mean, I did business first at UTS.
Yes.
And then when I was doing law, I wasn't too clear when I very first started.
Yeah.
But I was doing some volunteer work in my holidays. And so kept doing that, you know, in Africa, mostly. So I kept kind of doing that in my holidays and into when I'd finished the law and I was working in law. And then, yeah, it just sort of came to me that I could actually do this for a job.
Tell me about Africa. What were you doing there?
Yeah, so this was in countries like Tanzania, Kenya. Also, I did a little bit of stuff with Lawyers Without Borders in Namibia.
Yeah.
And so some of it was just working in orphanages, Friends Orphanage School in Uganda, and the SOS Children's Villages in Namibia. Yeah, so just doing a few things like that. And then combining it a little bit, like with Namibia, I was doing a bit of pro bono work with Lawyers Without Borders over there.
Yep.
There was a trial of about 120 people, a treason trial, and they'd been in prison for a long, long time, and the court case was being held inside the prison. So I was doing that during the week, and then I'd go and do the Friends Orphanage, the SOS, sorry, on the weekend.
Wow. Yeah. How were you first introduced to humanitarian work?
Well, I guess it was a... it was a shift across from just doing kind of development, poverty sort of work. And I heard of this organisation, Red R Australia, and there's these different rosters across the world. And the one that we've got in Australia, they do the training for the humanitarian work. So you do training in essentials and security, personal security and communications, and then that gets you through the process of getting onto a roster.
Yeah.
And then when you're on the roster, you get these jobs come out. So if there's other UTS graduates who are interested in doing it, it's something you can kind of dip your toe in. Like if you're working full-time for government or an engineering firm or even a hospital or whatever, if you've got a flexible employer that will say, I'll give you 3 or 6 months leave without pay, then that's the sort of thing. You can be on the roster, something comes up, then you could go off and build bridges in a refugee camp or whatever and then go back to your normal job.
And they're not associated with any churches or anything?
No, no churches. I mean, they get donations. They also are largely funded by the Australian government. It's a form of aid, really. So they will give money, but they'll also give people effectively. So they're putting kind of experts in the field. And there's two sort of circumstances where they'll put you. One is if there's a massive scale-up. Mm-hmm. So at the moment I'm working on the Rohingya crisis in Bangladesh. We've got people coming in by the tens of thousands. We're already over half a million people. So the organisations have to scale up really quickly. So it's bringing people like me in. And then the other one is where you have a particular sort of skill that they don't already have in country and they want to bring you in to do a specific thing. And so mine's kind of a bit of both because I do humanitarian protection. So I'm sort of coming in and advising the operation on how to promote safety and dignity for the people who are affected by the crisis.
Why don't we... we'll talk about Bangladesh a bit later, but why... why don't we hear about these crises as much in Australia? Something happens, maybe a natural event will happen in the world, and it just gets covered for a little bit and then forgotten about. Why does that happen?
I think it's about the people who are affected or the place that's affected. If it's a place that looks like where we live, if it's people that look like us, then we can feel that compassion and we want to know more. So if it's a Paris thing or if it's a US thing, everyone goes, wow. And I think it's part of saying that could be us, you know. Whereas if it's something where people already live in a different way, maybe there's a high population or a different way of living, then people go, oh, well, that's what you expect, Afghanistan having another IED attack, it is what it is, or something in a highly populated country and there's a flood and people drown and, oh, well, you know, it is what it is. Mm. So I think there's just that different level of interest and compassion for people.
You did mention you were working with Lawyers Without Borders in Namibia, but you also, maybe this was a little bit after you travelled and worked in Sierra Leone?
Yeah, so
what
I did something
there. What was the situation like there?
Yeah, so Sierra Leone, I was connected in with the Sierra Leone Institute for International Law as well, mm-hmm. and they were going through at that stage this kind of process, transitional justice process where they were trying people who'd been involved in the civil war there. And so I was doing a little bit of work with the institute there, as well as I did a bit of teaching at the university there. And it was just really interesting.
Was that in law?
That was in law,
wow.
Yeah. And it was really interesting because the first class I started by saying, I'm not going to dictate. So they were used to learning by dictation.
Oh, wow.
And so they were all ready to write down word for word. And I couldn't think of something more boring than spending 3 hours dictating to people. So I said, look, I'm not going to dictate. And their faces fell. And then I said, but if you have a USB stick, I'll put my book on international trade law on your stick. And then you've got that and we can work together. So then they're all really happy, apart from giving me a lot of viruses on my laptop. So then we did the class and I was teaching them that day on WTO, World Trade Organization law, and I got them to do a moot, like a practice court case, if you like, between two parties. And I did it over fair trade chocolate and competition and so on. Anyway, they just got so into it. Like, they got their heads around the law in that time, and they were just, you know, it was just so much a better learning experience than dictation.
Yeah. Really immersive, I guess, as well. Mm. So you were teaching a little bit there, but then you were also representing people, did you say, from the Civil War?
Well, part of that was looking at some of the human rights issues. So One of the things that I noticed, for example, around Freetown was there wasn't a lot of amputees, and I had expected to see a lot of amputees because one of the defining features of the Civil War had been, do you want a short sleeve or a long sleeve, cutting people's arms off. And I didn't see them around, and so I was told that apparently the government doesn't really want them to be around in the area, in the part of the city. So I found out where they were, and I travelled out to see them. And it was just about the cosmetics, I guess, of it, of people being moved. And, I mean, what was really interesting to me was their drive to want to just have a livelihood. So they weren't wanting, oh, look, woe is me, there was this civil war, I had my arm chopped off, you know, help me, give me something for free. No, there was a double amputee guy with his child, and he said, look, if we could just get enough to start a bakery, we can create bread, we can have our own business, we can look after our kids, and they can do that sort of work even with the double amputation. So those sort of people, they really just want a hand up, not a handout.
In 2013, you were working in Afghanistan as Gender and Protection Officer for the United Nations World Food Programme. What did that entail? What does that mean?
Yes, so so what that is, it's looking at, so the gender part is understanding how the roles, the power, responsibility and relationships between men and women can affect food utilisation. So, for example, in some of these countries, men and boys will eat first. The women might prepare the food, men and boys eat first, and then women and girls eat second. So that can then affect their food security because they're less likely to get the protein. And if you're in a position where the girl is going to be married probably when she's not yet a teenager, then the family won't put a lot of investment into her for her food security and her health because they know that she's going to go. So that's the gender part, and then the protection part is about safety and dignity. So putting those together, the effort by the World Food Programme is to try and achieve some benefits in gender equality through their programming. So an example is if you send your girl to school, then you get a take-home ration of oil each month.
Why?
Because you sent your girl to school.
Oh, okay.
You know, like it's a conditional transfer that's encouraging girls to get an education. And similarly, they had a program which was a six-month functional literacy and vocational skills training for women.
Yep.
So a six-month course, and in that time you receive a full ration, food ration for your family for the 6 months. So it's those sort of things that are encouraging not just food security, but also some women's empowerment, gender equality.
What was the situation like in Afghanistan when you were there? Were you in Kabul, was it?
I was in Kabul, and I also had field missions to Jalalabad, Herat, Mazar, Badakhshan and Kandahar. So I moved around a fair bit. It was fairly insecure. I mean, you know that people would like to kill you or whatever. So you move around in armoured vehicles, and I don't mean armed, but armoured, just reinforced. And there's all these different security protocols and radios and all of that. So they do keep you very safe. And it was interesting work. You know, I also did a little bit of volunteer teaching at Gawashad, which is an institute for gender and women's empowerment. It was a UTS graduate, Naseema Rahmani, that looks after that. So I did a bit there. And it was really good, you know, to see some of the younger people, some of the Hazara adolescents who were getting that opportunity to study and that, you know, they could just look forward to the future of Afghanistan.
You're listening to The Chat on 2SER 107.3. My name is Leah Tsamaglu, and I'm talking to gender and protection specialist Michelle Sanson.
Do you feel like you made a difference for women while you were there? I mean, I know that's a very broad... Do you feel like you made a small change?
Yeah, look, I feel sometimes... Yeah, sometimes you can see something tangible. Yeah. Other times you might plant some seeds and then they can grow later. So, for example, I did some work on the Syria refugee response and that was across the Middle East. And I remember with Lebanon that there was some staff there and we did some work on the training and we looked around at the distribution points and did a few things. And then I was contacted nearly 2 years later with a follow-up on something to do with humanitarian principles. So it showed me that those things had taken root there.
Speaking of Syria and the Middle East, this was in 2014. This was in the beginning of the war, wasn't it? And even, was it during the Arab Spring time that you were there?
So they'd had the Arab Spring and it was kind of in between the start and when people started going more to Europe. So at that stage, the bulk of people were in places like Lebanon, Jordan, were the two main ones. Turkey, they were starting to have quite a strong move towards Turkey. There were still some in Egypt as well.
Yeah.
So I was based in Jordan and just moving a bit around the region. And
Would you be able to explain about like what you were doing?
Yeah, so it's a similar sort of thing in terms of helping people. Say, for example, if you're doing assistance that's in one area, you might be quite focused on, well, we've got this many people to feed and we've got to do these calorific requirements and they've got to go from A to B. Mm. Whereas I come in and go, okay, but who are we feeding and what are their relationships? So, for example, in Jordan, we were giving assistance in the Zaatari refugee camp and there was another refugee camp being built at the time. And so it's looking at what would be of most dignity for these people. So maybe in the early days when people first come in, you might need to give them wet feeding. So that's something that's cooked or maybe some biscuits. And then you might move to giving them dry rations because that's more dignity because you can cook it yourself. Mm. And then once they've got pots and pans and settled, then you could just give them a voucher, an e-card, so that then they can go into a shop and shop for themselves. And that's also more protective, for example, than giving a woman a 50-kilo bag of rice, which is difficult to carry back to your shelter, and then you have to pay someone to move it for you, and then you're exposed to the risk of sexual and gender-based violence, you know, when you get back to that shelter. So being able to go and just get things a little bit is more protective for them, and it's more empowering as well.
What's the situation like in the refugee camps in the Middle East in comparison to the refugee camps in Europe, which we actually know a little bit more about, or if you've been to Europe, it's very visible as well. Was it a little bit better in the Middle East? Or?
Well, I haven't seen the refugee camps in Europe, so I can't really compare those two. I can compare the camps of where I'm working at the moment in Bangladesh, for example, than in Syria. And in Syria, I guess the Zaatari camp had 120,000 people in it at the time, and that was it was quite mature in its development, so people had their own caravan, I guess you would call it, and there was latrines and, you know, there was a few things that they had to sort out, which is that in terms of there's this thing called sphere standards, they're like the minimum standards for assistance, and there's certain ratios like how many people per toilet and how many square metres and so on. So in a refugee camp, you would normally put a certain amount of houses and you would have your latrines, but then you have to adjust that for culture. Mm. So what they were finding was that families would not have the women and girls go to the latrine in the night, and so they were just digging a little trench behind their tents and going there. But then that obviously has health consequences. So, and also it was a porous surface with a water table underneath. So these sorts of things where you sometimes have to adjust what you're doing. But all of that had happened in the Zaatari camp. Whereas where I'm working at the moment in Bangladesh, it's this massive influx of people. And some of them are staying with existing refugees. There's about 34,000 registered refugees. There's about 200,000 what they called undocumented Myanmar nationals already there. And then what the government's done is open up all this forest area. So we're talking about really fragile black plastic and bamboo sort of shelters, latrines popping up, but some of them are just like a plastic periphery, and then on the inside there isn't really a toilet there, it's just a bit of grass. So it's really early days, and at the moment over there the government has kindly opened up this 3,000 acre land, and it is massive, like it's the size of Washington DC that it's going to be built. And it's sad because this is a poor country and they only had 3% forest cover, and now they're giving all this forest for this crisis. And even things like elephants, the last 240 Asian elephants in the wild, well, that's their stomping ground, and now that's going to be people's houses. So it's really very generous of Bangladesh to do this, you know, very compassionate. And they're already a very small and overpopulated country as it is. This is an incredible thing. And I guess that's one thing I would say, is that I notice in the countries where people have experienced hardship that they're a lot more compassionate. So the Bangladeshis remember the Liberation War of the 1970s, and they know that if they hadn't have taken these people, they would be dead. And similarly, I saw in the Kurdish region of Iraq, you know, the Kurds were really very hospitable to the Syrians, so because they understand. They understand what it's like. Whereas here, you know, we might take 20,000 people and
very
we go, oh, you know, they're coming in and they're invading the country, and it's just a really different mindset.
Speaking of mindsets, and I'm going to ask you the reverse as well afterwards, but you fly from Australia to another country, it's almost like another world. How do you get prepared for that mentally? Does it take you a couple of days to acclimatize?
No, I don't know. It seems quite natural, yeah, because people can ask that at the other end as well, like how do you settle back into society?
That's what I wanted to ask you as well afterwards.
No, I mean, it seems, for me anyway, it seems fairly natural. I mean, we have got training of how to prepare yourself psychologically. So often I'm just really busy before I go because I'm trying to organise visas and change money and or stuff to do with family and friends, or maybe renting out my apartment. So I'm just go, go, go. So in some ways I get on the plane and fly out and go, okay, I'll have a rest on the plane. And then things start fresh when I'm over there. I think you do have to be quite flexible in what you're doing and just not be very specific of I have to eat these things and, you know, this is what I need to be satisfied. Instead, you've just got to go with what you've got. So, for example, like I did some work on Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines. Now, that was a deployment where come ready, meaning I had a bag with a tent and food and, you know, I was bringing everything so that if I needed to be somewhere that I would sleep in a tent, then I could do that. But if there's other people who don't feel comfortable with that, they can do different sorts of crises. There's there's conflict, which can be protracted. There's development settings. There's natural disaster. There can be some that are a combination of each. So it just depends. Like with a natural disaster, if you're there in the beginning, then you're obviously going to rough it a bit. But if you come at the 3 to 6 month mark, then you settle in. So no, I don't really feel like psychologically it's a big thing.
What about when you come back? Is it hard to get back into? Do you sort of look at Australia and go, we have it so easy? My friend called me to complain about the most first world problem, and I've just come back from Bangladesh and blah blah blah. Like, what is it like coming back after, you know, weeks and weeks of intense work?
Look, it is different. But I feel it's quite nice in a way that people are able to worry about those things, and those are very real for them. So it's not really for me to say you shouldn't be fussing about you know, what shape your bum is today, because it doesn't matter. Because it does, it matters to them. And I guess it's a similar sort of thing if you had a child who was worried about something in the schoolyard. You wouldn't say to them, oh, well, I've got financial problems and I've got to get the car fixed. So it's just not, it's just completely different worlds. So I just slip straight back into that world. And not many of my friends ask me a lot about it. They know I'm off there doing something. They don't go into a lot of details.
Wow.
So,
and do you think that everyone should sort of participate in a bit of, you know, humanitarian aid work overseas in their lives, or does it take a certain type of person? What's your opinion on that?
Well, I think if it interests you, then I think it's definitely something to give a try. If it's something that's completely freaky and foreign and you're just not interested in going anywhere, then that's fine as well. You can give some donations or earn megabucks and pay good tax, and all of that goes into a contribution. So you don't physically have to go. But I do think that if all people have some exposure to overseas, to developing countries, to just understand what that's like, and that could be by going on holidays to some of these places. It doesn't have to be doing the humanitarian work. And in fact, I think you have to get yourself, your ego in check, so to speak, to do the work. If you're going in there with this kind of white saviour complex, then you're going in there for yourself. You're not going in there for the people. And that's really something that can do more harm than good.
That's what I wanted to ask about. As a Westerner, do you feel like, do you have those feelings of sometimes imposing Western values on a different culture than your own?
Yeah, I mean, I always try and connect with the national staff and I learn as much as I can from them. I always try to dress in a way that they would feel comfortable. And I feel like they open up to me so that I'm better able to do my work and they can see that I'm not here to impose Western values or particular set onto them, but I am here to try and, you know, earnestly promote safety and dignity. And to do that, you have to understand how people think, what their cultural preferences are, and they might be quite different to yours. But actually, what I found, the more you learn about different cultures, the more you see a logic in it. And the perception that people might have from the outside, you know, you can look, for example, at some people look at a Muslim woman, they go, oh, she's so downtrodden. And those women look at us and go, oh, they're so, you know, they feel sorry for us. Yeah. And I remember I was on a plane once, I can't remember where I was travelling from and to, but there was a man to my right, and he was a very large man, so he was taking up like 2.5 seats, and then there was me. So he was talking to me, and he just looked like he was going to cry. Like, he said, I just feel so sorry for you. Doesn't your family love you that they would let you go travelling by yourself and nobody to keep you safe? You know, he was really sad for me. And whereas we define that as the epitome of autonomy and empowerment, that I can just go flitting around the world by myself. I don't need someone to look after me. It's just those different perceptions of the same thing.
Do you find it, have you found it difficult as a woman sometimes travelling to certain countries?
Well, I always take a ring that I can put on the married finger so that if I'm in a place where it's not, it just doesn't make any sense not to be married, I can at least look that way.
Yeah.
I do feel that in some countries I'm already looked down upon or looked as a prostitute, which is just the way, like, say, for example, in Oman, there was a lot of Russian prostitutes around. And so I would get into a taxi that asked me if I'm from Russia and things like that. Or, you know, you might be in the supermarket and somebody grabs your backside. And I don't see that as me. I just see that as them having the limited exposure to Western women that you get out of Hollywood movies and pornographic magazines. So naturally they will form that opinion. That's it. So they look at me and they see that. And also one thing that's different, I notice, is the difference between the relationship between the body and sex. So, for example, if you're in Brazil, there's a great deal of difference. Like, a person could be virtually naked on the beach. It's not a come on to anyone. They're just enjoying life and the body. You know, they're going for a swim. They could be 75. They could be 15. Nobody really cares. Whereas in some countries, the sex and the body are so closely connected that if you show even your shoulder, that's considered to be a sexual thing. Even in places where eye contact is considered to be a sexual come on. So for that, you can see how even if you just dress in a way that is culturally appropriate, you're already behind the eight ball because they already have those projected things on you. So I don't take it personally. I just see it as, well, that's, I've come into their environment, so they're going to take me as they will. And then some people will change their opinion over time.
You've travelled around the world. You've visited over 70 countries. Have you, has one place left an impression that you wanted to share?
Well, I thought it was interesting in Mindanao, I think in the southern Philippines, because it's just such a beautiful place and the people are fantastic, but they're just plagued by decades upon decades of these repeated conflict and also this thing called Rido, which is like clan violence between the families, and then bits of natural disaster and just underdeveloped from not being invested in. So you just see how much it wears people down. Like, why would you make an effort to plant your rice and prepare for a good harvest if the chances are that you'll be displaced from that land because of some sporadic conflict? It just really undermines all those things like education and health and all the things that are the ingredients towards what we have. And I think here we don't really understand just how good we have it, that, you know, we take for granted that we have law and order. Law and order that enables us to go to school or to go to the health clinic, and that we can go and get a decent level of service without paying a great deal of money. And so all of those things, the nutrition, the education, the peace and security, all of that contributes to what we achieve. And I know there's people, I've heard friends even say, oh, you know, they could fix their problems if they just stopped having children. So, but if you unpack that, first of all, it's the notion that a female has control over her body, and that's not always the case. They don't have control over the number and spacing of births because the access to sexual and reproductive health services are just not available. And then there's economics. You have to have a basic level of education to understand this is what it costs to bring up a child, and we might make a choice to have less children. So there's just all these different perceptions.
With government aid budgets decreasing around the world, I guess in Australia but also in the US, where do you see the future for humanitarian and aid work?
I guess the future is going to have to be in the individuals. And we're starting to see businesses, like there's that Thank You company where they invest all their profits into these sorts of endeavours. And I think that's where we're going to be going as a society in the future, that people are going to say, well, actually the big accumulation of wealth and assets is kind of hollow. We don't need that much. Let's have a look at what we need to live and what actually means something. And I forgot the guy's name. He used to be the president of Uruguay, José Mujica, I think it was. Anyway, so he was really interesting because he, as a president, gave back the large majority of his wage, and he was able to have a presidential jet, which he said, no, we'll use that for medical evacuations. He got around in his Volkswagen. He grew his own vegetables. Cool. You know, he just, he did what he did. And he said that he had been held in solitary confinement for some time, and he had a lot of time to think. And during that time, he realise that if you can't be happy with very little, then you can't be happy. So what I think is that sort of mindset will increasingly take on, where people will say, well, having that latest handbag or shoes or latest model of car or whatever gadget, it's not really that important. And how do I want to live my life? Because whenever you buy something, if you buy a shirt that's $300, well, how long did it take you to earn the money to be able to buy that shirt? And is that giving you the value? And if it is, I'm happy for you. But if it's not, then maybe it's about making those choices. So these people of the Thank You company, well, they could probably make mega bucks, but they choose to do that work, and that has more meaning for them.
That was Gender and Protection Specialist Dr. Michelle Sanson talking to me on the chat. That's all for the chat this week. If you like the show, you can subscribe to our podcast via SoundCloud or iTunes or from our website, which is 2ser.com/thechat. The show is produced with the support of the University of Technology, Sydney and 2SER 107.3. I'll catch you next week.
is taken by a robot? Where does all your e-waste go? How do you